Questions?
So, no homework was posted for the...
Zeyman effect? Yes, that's true. Yeah, so the, I don't know, we talked some about the homework problem, right? Homework has proven to have no useful effect. The idea of homework being to correct your errors before the exam rather than after the exam. So.
I'd say homework is useful as long as we get it done.
Yes. So your suggestion is to force you to get it done on a day certain.
So I would not say don't assign us homework, I would say.
Yeah.
Assign us homework.
Yeah, and I think you also said start taking off points if it's not.
That too.
Yes, and I think that that'll be the plan. So we have a big chapter that deals with approximation methods, and I'll probably have a moderately big problem set that deals with all of those approximation methods, and then have a date on a due on a date certain with 10% loss per day thereafter, something like that. But it's probably still going to be enough that you don't want to do what you've been doing and put off that big bomb until the weekend. Because you will be able to do them in pieces, right? We'll cover one after another. And today we're talking about perturbation theory. But to review what we talked about, the Zeyman effect. So the Zeyman effect was an early, evidence of quantum mechanics, question mark? I'm not sure I would exactly say that. So Zeyman was working prior to quantum mechanics at all, and he got his Nobel Prize after Bohr but before Schrodinger, so it was still in the context of old quantum mechanics. Zeyman himself was an experimenter. The guy who did the theory was Lorentz, of Lorentz force fame. So what Zeyman effect has to do is the breaking of rotational symmetry. If we put an atom in a magnetic field, now there's a special direction. And so whereas in the past we had lots of degenerate states, now we're going to break that degeneracy. And according to the orientation of the orbit, that is to say the fraction of the angular momentum that's in the z direction, we're going to get various energy outputs. So remember from two times ago that if we want to put a magnetic field in the Hamiltonian, this was the secret. P is not the mechanical momentum, it's the canonical momentum, and so P minus QA is the mechanical momentum, and it's going to go in for 1/2 mv squared, where the P was by itself. We have a lot of choice for A, for a uniform magnetic field. We choose one that is fairly symmetric looking, and then as a result, the Hamiltonian, we have whatever Hamiltonian was there to begin with. We have this term here, which you should look at as being a mu dot b with a gyromagnetic ratio of q over 2m, the classical value. If the thing is an electron, and it is for the Zeyman effect, then we're also going to have a mu dot b for the spin magnetic dipole moment, where the g factor, classical value is wrong by about a factor of 2, and the g factor corrects for it. And we also have a quadratic term from A squared. And in the context of the Zeyman effect, we're going to assume that that's small. If you make B big enough, it's not small, going quadratically as opposed to linearly. So Paschen is the guy who dealt with that, and I'm not sure we'll deal extensively with that. So this is our Hamiltonian then. We put the piece of S and L together to give something that's in terms of J. And then we almost have a Hamiltonian with eigenvectors that we know, except for S. The remaining piece of S, G minus 1 of S, is not going to be in general in the direction of J. So what we wanted to do is to calculate the average value of the spin in the z direction, and that's going to modify the Hamiltonians. And through detailed calculation, so we looked at the particular case where we had, say, hydrogen or sodium or potassium, where we have an excited electron that's in a p state, and spin, we have a single electron that's in a p state. So if we have spin 1/2 and angular momentum 1, we get total angular momentum that's either 3/2 or 1/2. Hun says that the 1/2 level is going to be the low one. And we then proceeded to write down what these wave functions were and calculate the average value of spin. And we did it for every possible value of m, and what we saw is that the answer was proportional to m with some constant out front that we figured out was 1/3 in the case of the 3/2 states and minus 1/3 in the other case. And in the ground state, which was an s state, that same value was 1. So the upshot for all of this is that these states all split by differing amounts. And that leads to multiple lines according to exactly what transition is going on. The so-called normal Zeeman effect, which is practically speaking rare, that requires us to have singlet states, whereas we have doublet states. So this is not a normal case that we've been studying. It's anomalous, which is to say it's the usual case. In order to have the usual Zeeman effect with Lorentz's explanation, we need to get three lines out, and the three lines come from having identical splittings for the states, and then we have a selection rule that says that the m value changes by either plus minus 1 or 0. Questions? So the Zeeman effect is kind of a canonical example of a sort of problem we're interested in solving with perturbation theory. So the idea in perturbation theory is that we have a problem that we can solve. In this case, it was the hydrogen atom. And we have something that's small compared to the forces that are involved in the hydrogen atom, right? The magnetic field you can produce in a laboratory, particularly in before 1900, is not going to make a big effect on the orbital motion of the electrons. It's going to be dominated by the nuclear force. The other thing that is, I don't know, nice is maybe the wrong word, is that the perturbation has an adjustable parameter in it. So we can let B be big or small. We can see how these energy levels change as a function of B. So speaking generically, what we're going to have is an exact Hamiltonian, which I'm going to denote with a double barred H. That is the sum of a problem that we can solve, H, and some extra potential, which has an adjustable constant that's associated with it. So lambda is a number that, like the magnetic field, that could be conceivably most anything. Not uncommonly in perturbation theory, there isn't an adjustable constant. So for example, we can treat relativity as a perturbation on non-relativistic mechanics, but there isn't a, you know, it's either there or it's not there. But we can kind of arbitrarily put some constant in front of it and imagine what would happen if we turned on relativity. But in fact, the only thing that would be physically available would be the full strength potential. So under those circumstances, the only thing we really care about is lambda equals 1, where we have the quote-unquote real problem. In the case we have here, in fact, we have an adjustable parameter. So upshot, if we have a perturbation and there's no adjustable parameter, willy-nilly add one in, and in the end, you're only going to be interested where that parameter is 1. But not uncommonly, Zeeman effect, Stark effect, those are cases where there really is something that's adjustable, and we can see what happens as we go from 0 to 1. Okay, so next we've got kind of a notational problem, which you can see the start of with double barred H's. And that is, we're going to have a lot of indices. So first of all, we have the original Hamiltonian with its eigenfunctions, phi I. Okay, so this is the known problem. So for the hydrogen atom, we know those energies are like 13.6 eV over n squared, and we have formulas for what those wave functions, which I'm calling phi. We're interested, of course, in the solution to the real problem. And those I'll denote with double bars every place. And in particular, if we look at these energy states as a function of lambda, we have the states for lambda equals zero, which are the unperturbed levels, you know, say E1, E2, E3, etc. And we're interested in how they change with lambda. You know, so maybe this one goes down and this one goes up and this one goes, you know, this away. So exactly what happens to any one of these energy states depends on which one we're talking about. So let's say we're thinking about how the third energy level changes as a function of the adjustable parameter lambda. So everything is going to depend that we're talking about three. So I could put we're talking about n equals 3 every place on all of the on all of these things, you know, 3, 3, 3. But since that occurs every place, it's going to be a lot easier not to write it at all. So the book writes the fact that we're talking about how the third state changes with lambda with a superscript. So if you're trying to compare what they're doing and what I'm doing. Okay, so you know that you can expand any function you want in kind of a Taylor series expansion. So I'm going to be interested in what the real energy is as a function of lambda. And I know that for lambda equals zero, it's going to be En, where n is the state we're talking about, but then they're going to be higher order terms. You know, terms that are proportional to lambda, lambda squared, lambda cubed, etc. And I'm going to name these terms with subscripts. So this is E1, E2, E3, etc. And this is potentially confusing. So the way it's going to work is subscripts on the double barred quantities deal with the Taylor series expansion of that quantity. Subscripts on the unbarred quantity deals with what state we're talking about. So here the subscript is the state, and here the subscript is the Taylor series term. And in the background is the fact that we're talking about how a particular state changes as a function of lambda. And we're going to call that the nth state, but we're not going to write it anyplace. Okay, well, if the energy changes as a function of lambda, the wave function is going to be different for different values of lambda. So just as before, I can think about Taylor series expanding that wave function. You know, kind of like that. And the problem is solved if I can tell you what the Taylor series expansion is for the energy and the wave function. That would be good. As is frequently the case, we're not usually going to be interested in all of the terms. We're just going to be interested in the important terms, which we're hoping are the first few terms. And if we're lazy, maybe the first non-zero term. Okay, so with that, it's a matter of plugging into our original Hamiltonian and seeing, you know, what has to be combined with what. So the original equation, of course, was H double bar psi double bar is E double bar psi. And what that's going to read then is H plus lambda V times psi. And psi double bar is equal to the initial wave function plus lambda times psi double bar 1 plus lambda squared times psi double bar 2 plus lambda cubed psi double bar 3, an infinite number of terms. And that wants to equal E double bar. And E double bar is the initial energy plus lambda E double bar 1 plus lambda squared E double bar 2 plus lambda cubed E double bar 3. Lots of terms there. Times psi, which is, of course, phi plus lambda psi double bar 1 plus lambda squared psi double bar 2 lambda cubed psi double bar 3. Okay, so that's what has to be the case. So we have a Taylor series expansion on the left-hand side of the equation. We have a Taylor series expansion on the right-hand side of the equation. And the only way it's going to be true is if the coefficient of lambda is the same on both sides of the equation. So we can look at the terms that have lambda to the zero on the left and on the right, and they better be the same. We can look at the terms that have lambda to the first power on the left and right, and they have to be the same. And so it goes. So we want to look at, get tired after about three, we have to look about what terms are going to have. So lambda to the zero only comes about from this. And that was the original solution to the problem. The so-called unperturbed problem. Okay, so interest starts to come with the higher order terms. So what we're going to have is H times psi double bar 1 plus V times phi n. That wants to equal En times psi double bar 1 plus double bar E times phi n. And for second order terms, we're going to have H times double bar 2 plus V double bar 1, and that wants to equal En double bar 2 double bar 1, psi 1, double bar 2, basically psi 0. For the third order term, we've got H psi double bar 3 plus V psi double bar 2 is basically 0, psi double bar 3, E1, psi double bar 2, E2, psi double bar 1, plus E3, phi n. So we want to solve all of these equations. This one we already solved. So first of all, let me rewrite these a little bit. Supposedly making them a little bit easier to solve by putting the psi n on one side of the equation. So if I bring this term over to this side of the equation, what I've got is H minus En psi double bar 1 is equal to E1 minus V phi N. Same game here. Bring this guy to this side of the equation. What we've got is H minus En psi double bar 2 is equal to E2 minus V I guess that's E1 minus V psi 1. And then we've got, so we move this term over to that side of the equation. We also have this guy then. So I move this guy over here, and what we've got is E1 minus V psi 2 plus E2 psi 1 plus E3 phi N. Okay. So now we have to solve all of these equations. And we have one important useful fact, and that's completeness. So no matter what this function is, and currently we have not the slightest idea what it is, we can write it as a superposition of the original functions. Right? Any function, so in particular whatever that is, can be written as a superposition of the corresponding values. Okay, so now we have a real important, somewhat subtle trick. So without loss of generality, I'm going to assume that all of these guys, from 1 on up, contain none of the original function. This is basically a choice of normalization. Unfortunately, it's not a choice of normalization that leaves it normalized, but it is a choice of normalization. What we're insisting is that in the final answer, the coefficient of phi n is exactly 1. And that it happens in the first state. You might notice that if there was some phi n in one of these guys, it would be annihilated by this term anyway. Right? Because if we put a little bit of this one to be phi n, then we would get E minus E. We'd get 0 anyway. Matt, you're not happy.
No, I think I follow
it. Okay.
What was the first part starting this again? You said
so without loss of generality, we're assuming that the only phi n, I never defined psi double bar 0, but you understand what it would be. There's no phi n. There's none of the original state in any of the higher order terms. And that's without loss of generality because you can do that, right? Whatever the expansion is for this whole wave function, you could set the coefficient of phi n equal to 1 and just scale everything else up or down. You know that this equation here doesn't set the normalization of psi. You could multiply psi by 5 and it would be just as much a solution to that equation as it was before. So these equations don't set normalization, and we decide to set it by setting the coefficient of phi n to be exactly 1. Okay? So I repeat, this does not produce a normalized double bar psi. But that's okay. Okay, so what we want now is to find these various values of these various energy values, and finding the wave functions is nice too, but probably the energy is the most important thing to find. And now we have kind of the second trick, and that is if we take any one of these equations, but let's start with the first one. If I take that equation and I multiply it by phi n complex conjugate and integrate it, I'm going to get zero. So let's see how that works. So what I'm saying, if I take phi n, and what I had here was h minus e n on a function that I don't know what it is, right? I have no idea what phi double bar phi 1 is. But remember that these guys are Hermitian operators. So even though they're written as operating on that guy, for free, I can bring them over to that side and have them operate on the bra as opposed to the ket. And on the bra, they're zero. Okay, so that's why I wrote these terms. That's true for any one of these guys. If I multiply them by phi n and integrate, I'm going to get zero. No, it's not. That would be true no matter what's going on. Because no matter what's going on with this guy here, I could bring it over to the bra side, and then h phi n is en. So I get en minus en is zero. Okay, so that's equal to zero, so the other side has to be equal to zero. So what I have then is that phi n double bar e1 minus v phi n has to be zero. And if I just split that up, what I have then is e1 is just a number. These energies are just numbers. So I get e1 times phi n phi n minus phi n v phi n. These phis are originally normalized of our original problem. So what I have then is that the perturbed energy is just plus, because it goes on the other side, phi n v phi n. Now, you've noticed, I hope, that one of the ways we make it possible to write down quantum mechanics is by not writing down as much as possible. Right? So that's really an integral, and I haven't bothered to write those integrals for a long time. And now I'm not going to bother to write much of this either. So I'm just going to abbreviate this as VNN. So in general, the subscripts of V are going to be the wave functions that I'm multiplying on the left and the right, and then integrating. Okay, so that's first important factoid. And in fact, that's what we were doing with the Zeeman effect. Remember, we found the expectation value of the spin as a way of finding out what the energy was under those circumstances. And I hope it is, you know, a little bit interesting, and it turns out to be practically useful, that I can find E1 without finding psi 1. So I can find the perturbed energy without finding the perturbed wave function. And that's going to turn out to be generally the case. In order to find E sub 5, I'm only going to need to know wave function sub 4. But we are interested in at least through E2, so off to the races. So how do I get what psi is? How do I now get what this guy is equal to? And so now basically is where that wo log is going to come into play. I'm going to plug in for psi whatever it takes to expand it. Right? So that perturbed wave function has to be expressible as some superposition of the original wave functions, and I'm going to plug that into the resulting equation. And then I'm interested in finding out what these C sub i's are. Okay? And this time, instead of before, I multiplied by phi n and I got the energy. Now I'm going to multiply by some phi j complex conjugate and do the integration. Okay. That means that this term is going to go to zero. Well, no. Take that back. This term is going to go to C sub j, right? So when we plug in this, orthogonality is going to kill all of these integrals except the particular one where I is equal to j, what we originally decided to multiply by. This term here is going to give us the kind of running out of space here. Okay, so let's just focus on what happens when h minus en hits one of these phi i's, right? Because there are phi i's in this sum. And what we're going to get, of course, is when h hits phi I, it's going to give us ei. And now when we multiply this by psi j and do this integration, the only surviving term is going to be C sub j, E sub j minus En. Do you follow that? So we plug in for psi an arbitrary linear combination of the wave functions. When H minus En hits that wave function, it's going to produce an Ei minus En. When we multiply it by phi sub j and do the integration, orthogonality is going to kill every term in that sum except the particular term where I is equal to j. And for that term, it's going to give us 1 by orthogonality. Okay? On the other side of the equation, if I multiply this by phi j and do the integration, this is just a constant. It comes out of the integral and it gives us 0 because phi j is not equal to n by definition, right? Because none of these terms here have an n. So on the other side of the equation, what we're going to get is just minus phi j v phi n. So I can rearrange this and say that Cj is just equal to Vjn, and I'm going to reverse the order to reverse the sign.
So why do we lose E1 on the right side?
We lose E1 because it's a constant, so it can come outside of the integral. So what we'll get is E1 phi j overlap with phi n, and by definition, there's no j is never equal to n. There's no n in the sum, and so that term is 0. Okay, so once I have a formula for these cj's, I can, at least theoretically, plug it back in to get the formula for what phi 1 is. Okay, so that's boxed result number 2. Okay, so what's E2? So the claim is, now that we know psi 1, we should be able to calculate E2 by the same sort of trick we used before. So if I take this equation and I multiply it by phi sub n complex conjugated, this term here, when it comes over on the bra, is going to be annihilated. So I'm going to get 0. This term here is just going to give me E2, right? Because phi n and phi n are orthonormal set. And here, we're going to get something we can calculate. Okay, so let's see what we got. So again, what we did is we took phi n and this was En and psi 2. That thing was guaranteed to be 0 because we could bring the operator over to the bra. And on the other side of the equation, what we have is, and we've got E1 and V. And then we've got E2. So this thing here is 1. So now our wo log comes. There is no phi n in psi 1. This is just a constant, so it comes outside of the integral. So what we've got here is minus phi n v psi 1. And we know what psi 1 is. Psi 1 is add up v j n divided by en minus ej times phi j. Okay, so what we're going to end up with then is this thing hitting that thing, right? So what we've got then is minus sum of vjn phi n v phi j all divided by en minus ej. And the whole game is to make this look simple. So here we had vjn, and here we have vnj, n going to j, and this all wants to be divided by en minus ej. So that's our second boxed result. This has a minus sign on it because it's on the same side as the E2. So what we've got is E2 is the sum of VNJ VJN divided by EN minus EJ. And it gets more and more complicated. The book has a footnote that tells you what E3 is. But basically, what happens is if we go to higher and higher terms, we get more and more things like this. We're tacking on things that are matrix elements, VJI sorts of things, divided by energy denominators. So we want these successive terms to be smaller, smaller, and smaller. So we're hoping that the matrix elements are small compared to the energy differences. Otherwise, we're going to have convergence problems. And I hope it's also clear, we've got a huge problem with degeneracy. So if we have two states that have the same energy, then we're going to get a zero in the denominator and all bets are off. So we're going to have to deal specially with the case of degenerate perturbation theory, when there are states that have the same energy and therefore would generate zeros in the denominator. Okay. So, what's an example of this process? So that's what this is about. So first of all, kind of an overall comment, the sort of textbook problems that I like are textbook problems that we can work two ways. So we can calculate what the energy is by perturbation theory, and we can calculate what the energy is exactly, and we can see if they are producing pretty much the same result. So if you look at the last page, what we have here are some energy level diagrams as a function of the adjustable parameter that's in the problem. So there's a horizontal line that goes through 10, and that turns out to be a state that in all orders of perturbation theory is unaffected. So the other lines you can see look like dual lines. And it turns out the lower line is the exact result and the upper line is second order perturbation theory. And I think you can imagine that if I added third order, fourth order, fifth order, I would have better and better convergence between the exact calculation and the real calculation. Pretty clearly, I have calculated the slope and the curvature of the exact result accurately with the second order perturbation theory. Okay, so we can actually compare exact and perturbation, and it's working about as well as you would expect. We have the linear and the quadratic terms of the expansion. Okay, so what is the problem that is being solved? The problem is infinite square well. That's nice because the functions are pretty easy. You know, remember they're just signs. So I have this square well that's between 0 and L, and the functions are just, you know, basically the standing wave solutions. And the perturbation I'm going to add is a delta function, an attractive delta function, right at the midpoint of the square well. Okay, so the first thing that you can see is that for any of these states that have a node right in the middle of the well, it's a delta function, so it only cares about the value of the function there. All of these matrix elements are going to be zero for it. So anytime I have a state, I or j there, that is like this, when I integrate that with the delta function, I get zero. Now there's a little bit of confusion between even and odd. So this one here, that's n equals 1, but I would call that an even state, right? This one here is n equals 2, but that's an odd state. So there's a reverse of parity between the n's and the corresponding parity of the state. So just keep that in mind. When we're summing over odd n, we're summing over the states that are, in fact, even. The other thing that's real nice about this problem is that not only are these integrals easy to calculate because they're delta functions, but they're all the same. Right? Because what I'm going to get, these functions are the square root of 2 over L times sine of kx. And so the amplitude The full amplitude always occurs at the midpoint of these n equals odd states. The full amplitude is always square root of 2 over L. So any of these integrals, the perturbation from J, N, these things are either 0 or they are equal to 2 over L. You buy that? So the 2 over L comes from the wave function basically squared, evaluated at the midpoint. At the midpoint is where it's where the sine is equal to 1, and so we're golden. The integrals are all easy and basically the same. Okay, so that gets us to this line here. As long as n and m are odd, the integral is just this 2 over L times the strength of the delta function, and I used an attractive delta function, so it's minus alpha multiplying everything. So according to perturbation theory, I have the original energy, I have the expectation value of V, and then I have a sum over all states. So in a typical problem, adding up all of the states is tricky. And usually one just continues until one gets tired. But as a matter of fact, mathematics can do that sum. And so in the end, we have a nice Taylor series expansion in terms of this quantity that I called Q in the end, for what the energy is. So the rest of the problem is doing it exactly, and we know that the solutions to the Schrodinger equation for this constant potential are going to be sines. So the only question is, what's the value of k? Before, the value of k had to be such that I got a zero at the far end, but now I'm going to have solutions that have a kink in them, right where this delta function is. You remember that the delta function, when you integrate it, gives you a change in the slope. So that's what's going on down here. The change in the slope at the midpoint is determined by the strength of the delta function at the midpoint. And in the end, I can kind of solve for what the energies are. And actually, it's kind of the reverse. If you notice here, I have an equation that gives me, from k, I can calculate q. Whereas I want the reverse from q, which is basically the strength of the potential, I want to calculate k. But Mathematica has the ability to reverse series, right? So if you look here, I can take the series for cotangent and I can ask it to invert the series. So instead of getting theta as a function of q, I can get q as a function of theta. And in any case, I'm off to the races and I get for my expansion exactly what I got from the and of course, more terms if I want them. I get exactly what I got from perturbation theory. Okay, so problems that involve simple harmonic oscillators and delta functions are prime territory for textbook problems because we can do the integrals relatively easily. Right, so if this were a simple harmonic oscillator and the potential were x, for example, I could write x in terms of raising and lowering operators and I could do lots of integrals pretty quickly. Kind of unfortunately, prime territory for this, circa 1920 when quantum mechanics was being developed. So incidentally, this is called Rayleigh-Schrodinger perturbation theory. So there's a classical version of it for waves that Rayleigh did, and then Schrodinger applied it to quantum mechanics. If we try and do this with atomic wave functions, it's not nearly as much fun, right? The formula for the atomic wave functions is kind of ugly. So Mathematica can certainly do those integrals, but it has trouble doing an infinite number of those integrals. So it can give us an approximate value for, so it can certainly give us first order perturbation theory, and it can give us approximate values for second order perturbation theory. The other big problem is, of course, the H atom has degeneracy, and we haven't begun to talk about how we deal with degenerate perturbation theory. It's not hugely different. It has kind of one little twist in it. Questions? So you asked me last time kind of what's the most important thing so far, and I said Clebsch-Gordan tree. Now, perturbation theory is one of these huge concepts that is of tremendous importance for actually doing any real sort of calculation. The number of solvable problems is pretty small. So in its kind of final form, this leads to Feynman diagrams, which are just a picture of what terms you need to calculate in order to find the various terms of perturbation theory. And I don't know, we can kind of see how that works in a crude sort of way. So Feynman's integrals basically have to do with relativistic quantum theory. And we're not doing relativistic quantum theory, but if we want something that looks a little bit graphical, think about the series of levels. And what we are interested in is one particular level, n. And what these equations have are integrals that connect two levels. Right? So for example, here we had an integral that connected the starting level to j, and then we had another integral that brought it back, and then we had to sum over all possible levels that we could connect to. If you look at the formula for the third order term, it basically looks kind of like this. That is to say, what we have is some series of connections that start at our level and end at our level, but can go through any arbitrary set of states. For any one of these sort of connections, we have a denominator, which is the energy difference between the corresponding states. So all of these statements go over pretty much one-to-one with Feynman once you've done all the extra complications of relativity and field theory. But it all is basically the same thing. Okay, so I think we'll call it quits there. Degenerate perturbation theory, next time.